Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point. In 1970, a barrel of crude oil cost $1.80. This week, it soared to a new high above $70 a barrel. The result, gas at $3 a gallon and climbing at a filling station near you, not to mention fears of inflation and economic slowdown. All this because of jitters over a nuclear showdown with Iran, political unrest in Nigeria, and the country's unquenchable thirst for foreign oil. Some say to get America on the road to energy independence, it's time to embrace the so-called carbohydrate economy, fuels derived from corn and other biomass. They say, imagine driving a car without consuming petroleum or generating pollution or making noise or going to war for oil. The skeptics say they're dreaming, but with oil above $70 a barrel, maybe it's time to dream. Up next on Point, debating the carbohydrate economy. Later in this hour, we'll look at new ideas about how to build a new energy economy based on biomass. But first, joining us from Houston is Amy Myers Jaffe. She's an energy fellow at Rice University's Baker Institute for Public Policy. And Amy Jaffe, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm glad you're here. I'd very much like to talk with you briefly about, before we get involved in this other discussion for the rest of the hour, I want to talk to you about why oil prices have climbed so high. First of all, we hear that this is about fears of geopolitical uncertainty, beginning with a standoff with Iran over its nuclear program. How does this affect oil prices?
Well, you know, we're in a very tight market. In other words, all of the extra capacity to produce oil is, you know, every drop of oil that we can get out of the ground, not only here in the United States, but in the Middle East and other countries, is basically being produced. So we don't have any padding. And so, therefore, if anything goes wrong, you know, it has an immediate market impact, and even anticipation that something might go wrong has an immediate market impact. So when you look at the nuclear standoff with Iran, the market perceives two possible scenarios that would take oil off the market. One is some kind of a breakdown in diplomatic negotiations with Iran that would result in the United States and its allies wanting to put on some kind of economic sanctions that might mean that we're going to block Iran from exporting its oil to the market. A second scenario, which be sort of a worst-case scenario, which I think is unlikely, but then one never knows in an unstable world, is that very senior Iranian officials have threatened that Iran has the capability to close the vital Strait of Hormuz, which is a little choke point that most Middle East oil tankers need to pass through to bring their oil to the United States and Asia and Europe.
Mm-hmm. So that would be a real choke, point. So oil traders will see that, will see the news, get the jitters, drive the price up. Is that the way it works, pretty much?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not just the oil trading community, though. Of course, the speculative community, the people who bet your pension fund on whether oil prices are going to go up and down are definitely in the market. But also, if you're a refiner or a distributor of oil or oil products, I mean, you have to hedge your bets in case there's a supply disruption. You need to be protecting your businesses.
Now, let me talk about a couple of other factors. We also hear about Nigeria. Political unrest there have led to rebel attacks on Nigeria's energy sector, shut down about a quarter of the country's oil production. How big a producer is Nigeria, and how big a factor is this on the rising prices?
Well, you know, Nigeria is a major supplier to the world, somewhere between 5% and 7% of world supply. But more importantly, sometimes oil has seasonal priority.
Mm-hmm.
So it happens that Nigeria's oil is the main oil that is used here in the United States and in Europe to produce gasoline. And so, therefore, any jitter over some cutoff of Nigerian supply has sort of instant reverberations into not only the crude oil price, but also anticipated gasoline prices.
I see. We're also hearing about big increases in the demand for oil from Asia, China in particular. I understand that China has now surpassed Japan as the world's second largest oil consumer after the U.S. So that's a big factor, correct?
Well, the Asian boom is a big factor, though. In fairness, China's oil demand has slumped off a little bit this year. But actually, and we Americans don't like to admit it, our increase in imports of oil over the last, say, 10, 12 years equals the amount of total current Chinese oil demand.
Wow.
So we, too, in the United States, have to think about how we use oil and what our policies are going to be in the future, because it's not just the new competition for supplies from Asia. It's also from the United States.
Now, you just said something really important that I hadn't heard before, so I want to just make sure that I absolutely understood it. We're talking about China's increased consumption of oil. You're saying that their increase is equal to their total consumption, just this year.
No, our increase for the past 10 years.
I see. Still, that's astounding, isn't it?
Right.
Wow.
It is equal to their total oil use. So to put that in perspective, in Europe and Japan, there have been very proactive policies, including burdensome taxes on motor fuel. And there's been no increase in motor fuel demand in Europe and Japan over the last 10 years. Whereas here in the United States, we've grown something between 2 and 3% a year. And because we're such a large country, it adds up to a tremendously large volume.
Mm. Now, I understand that President Hu of China, who is visiting the U.S. this week, is going to be meeting at the White House this week. One of the things on the agenda will be this issue of oil and oil consumption. Can anything helpful come out of that meeting with regard to these high prices?
Well, frankly, the Chinese have done some of the things that you hear commentators in the United States talk about. They just imposed a new purchasing tax on large vehicles and SUVs on the basis of their mileage standards, for example.
Mm.
So there probably are a lot of things that either could be done or might be looked at in China. One of the interesting areas for the United States and China to cooperate would be in two areas. One would be in emergency response. Say there was a problem in the Middle East or in Nigeria, the United States and China could coordinate the use of emergency stockpiles like our Strategic Petroleum Reserve, and that would help ease the market panic. A second area that seems very obvious would be to do joint research in new technologies, electric cars or hybrid vehicles or biofuels or coal to oil technologies. A lot of those things are things that both countries have a strong interest in. And as the old saying goes, two heads are better than one. It seems like something that the U.S. and China could work on together on a science basis.
Well, that would be encouraging if something like that came out of the meeting. Let me ask you this. Can OPEC do anything? In the past, OPEC nations have been able to increase or decrease production to move world prices up or down. Does OPEC have any leverage and potential to help the situation here?
Well, I think the OPEC countries made some very unfortunate decisions over the last few years to cut production to get prices higher. And now, in my opinion, they've somewhat lost control of the market. I mean, they are not making the investments that are needed to keep pace with demand. You mentioned rising demand from Asia. So they are basically not keeping pace with the requirement the world has for their oil. And the question is, you know, what can we do as the United States do diplomacy or our allies do to try to convince OPEC that their long-term interests come in supplying more oil to the market and making these investments? It's a very popular rhetoric in the Middle East and some of these other countries to say that they can get more money for their oil. I was recently out traveling in the Middle East and was asked to appear on Al Jazeera TV as an oil expert. And the question I got was, are our regional governments doing enough to raise the price of oil? They were concerned about the opposite. They were thinking that they might be leaving money on the table. So it really is an uphill battle to think about, you know, how to convince or incentivize OPEC to make the investments that it would take to get more oil on the market.
Interesting. President Bush said yesterday that the government should make sure that we watch very carefully, investigate possible price gouging. He said that before when prices have shot up, in particular after Hurricane Katrina. Is there any reason to believe that this is the result of price gouging and that some steps would be taken to bring the prices down?
Well, the interesting thing about that, there are some factors that are affecting retail gasoline prices, the prices for the additives for summer pollution-related additives that are needed for major cities in the United States have gone up. There's a little bit of a shortfall there. We're changing standards away from the additive MTBE, which had some water damage cases, and so we're moving away from that and moving on to corn-based ethanol. So we're going to have some transition costs that the consumer is going to pay for. But if you look at the historical relationship between U.S. crude prices and retail gasoline prices, the prices we're seeing today at the pump are out of line with historical relationships. They are much higher than the historical relationships would suggest. So there is a possibility that people were quick to the trigger, and that is something that really does need to be studied.
And Amy Jaffe, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And I'm happy to welcome from St. Paul, Minnesota, David Morris. He's vice president at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, and he's author of A Better Way, Driving Without Oil. And he is perhaps most noted for his 1992 book called The Carbohydrate Economy. And I want to welcome you, David Morris. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me on the show, Anthony.
Great. And let's start with that concept, the carbohydrate economy, and be quick to say this isn't a new Atkins diet. When we talk about a carbohydrate economy, you're talking about an energy economy based on things like corn, wood chips, switchgrass, other forms of biomass from which we could derive energy. How would it work?
Well, I invented the phrase carbohydrate economy to define an economy where we not only get food and feed from carbohydrates from plants, but we also get fuel and industrial chemicals. Anything you can make out of a hydrocarbon, you can make out of a carbohydrate. I mean, the hydrocarbons were carbohydrates at one point. They were plants millions of years ago, and when they died under great pressure, the oxygen was stripped out of the molecule, and what you ended up with was a hydrocarbon. People might not know that the first plastics were made not from oil, but they were made from cotton in the 19th century. To this day, in Hollywood, they call their films celluloids. And celluloid was a plastic that was derived from cotton, and it got its name because over 90% of cotton is cellulose. So we have a very long tradition. As of even 50 years ago, 60 years ago, really, the majority of plastics were bioplastics, and the majority of inks were made from vegetable oils, and the majority of chemicals, not quite the majority of chemicals, maybe about 35%, were made from carbohydrates. And then oil became real cheap after World War II, and the carbohydrate economy went into eclipse. And now it's coming back. It's coming back because of the high price of oil, but it's also coming back because we're learning the biology, biological sciences and biological engineering techniques are learning to make a very superior products much more cheaply from carbohydrates. So a carbohydrate economy is one where you look at the soil and you see it not only for food and feed, but you see it for industrial chemicals and fuels.
David Morris, it's so interesting. You bring up so many interesting things in that introduction right there. As you said, you've written that long ago, that industrializing nations were using essentially what you call carbohydrate economies and could do so again. But aren't our energy demands so much higher today? Didn't we move away from fuel derived from living plants to fossil fuels because we had to?
No, I don't think that we moved away because we had to, but you're right that that our energy demands are enormous today. And one, this is a very important point. Biomass or carbohydrates are not a silver bullet, but they are an important element in any kind of oil displacement strategy. Let's be clear that when we talk about oil displacement, we're pretty much talking about transportation. Over 60%, almost two-thirds of the oil that we use is being used for transportation. So that's really the sector we need to focus on. And in my report, A Better Way, Driving Without Oil, it basically proposes a strategy based on current technology. And let me be very brief about it. We know what a hybrid car is right now. Everybody loves hybrid cars. And the hybrid car is lovely. It has an electric motor and it has a gasoline engine.
It's essentially an electric assist, correct? It's an electric assist to a gasoline engine.
That's right. It's an internal combustion car with basically a motor assist. It can travel a very short distance on electricity only. If we allowed it to plug in to your wall socket so it could get its electricity from the grid system, and if we made the battery system, about 3 or 4 times larger, which is not a dramatic change, then suddenly it becomes an electric vehicle with an engine backup. And as an electric vehicle, lots of good things happen. First of all, we don't use oil to generate electricity. Actually, about 3%, 4% of our electricity is generated from oil. So when we drive on electricity, we don't use oil. Secondly, when we drive on electricity, we are non-polluting at the tailpipe, so it cleans up our cities. Third is there's no noise. Fourth is when we drive on electricity, we get the equivalent of about 100 to 125 miles per gallon. So electricity should be our primary fuel. Then for the engine backup, we already have cars that have flexible fueled engines, which means engines that can operate on any proportion of either gasoline or ethanol. And so those would be flexible fuel backup engines, and they would drive primarily on ethanol and biomass created ethanol. And so this solves two of the real problems related to electric cars and related to the carbohydrate economy. The Achilles heel of electric cars is that the batteries are very expensive. Mm-hmm. They weigh a lot, and you can only get 60 or 70 miles before you have to recharge, and recharging takes several hours. But if you have a backup engine, you don't have to worry about your performance and your driving limitations, so that overcomes that problem. And on the carbohydrate economy side of the equation, the engine side of the equation, we don't have enough biomass to displace a majority of our transportation fuels with existing technology and existing consumption. But if electricity becomes your primary fuel, if you're basically driving around Boston with electricity, but if you want to drive to Pittsburgh, you use biofuels, then we can reduce by 75% the amount of biofuels that we need, and then we can literally talk about the carbohydrate economy displacing 100% of our transportation needs.
Wow, that sounds too good to be true, but we're going to talk more about that. We're going to hear from a skeptic in a little while, but I'd love to get some callers in first because we have a lot who are backed up. Let's go to Charles, who's calling from Nashua, New Hampshire. Hi, Charles. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for having me on the air, and hello to your guests. Thank you for being there, and a very interesting topic to discuss. Basically, I'd like to make a comment without getting into paralysis of analysis. I'd like to report to you that here in New Hampshire, in Nashua, and various parts of the country, people are getting 100 miles per gallon using biodiesel. And this is a very simple thing. When Rufus Diesel, which is where the name came from, back in the 1800s, rolled into the World's Fair in the 1800s, he was operating on biodiesel. And I think that for many Americans, proactively, they're simply just getting diesel engines and getting the kits, which are very simple. You can have your local mechanic put them in at a minimal cost, and you can actually build or have built for you very at a cost-effective way and produce your own fuel.
Charles, thanks. It's a good suggestion. Let me put that out to David Morris. Thanks for the call. Biodiesel this is part of your carbohydrate economy?
Yes, this is part of the carbohydrate economy. Biodiesel means basically esterified vegetable oil. So think of it as vegetable oils mixed with diesel in the way that ethanol is mixed with gasoline. There is a limitation. I mean, I would say this about biodiesel. By all means, let's pursue it. Because I think it's an interesting additive. But there's a problem, and the problem is that we don't have a real big surplus of vegetable oils. And so you're not really going to be able to displace a significant percentage of diesel with vegetable oils, you know, even vegetable oils from all different kind of oilseed crops. And it may be better for us to think about vegetable oils as replacing lubricants and replacing hydraulic fluids. That is, for replacing the higher value petrochemical derived products that you use in your car, like your transmission fluid. So we might think of it that way. Ethanol, on the other hand, is derived from sugars. And sugars are enormously plentiful. In the United States, we get our sugars from corn, basically cornstarch. We convert it into sugars. And by the way, for those who are worried about the food versus fuel issue, when we take the starch out of the corn, we actually concentrate. We keep the protein in the corn, and we end up with an animal feed, which is actually more valuable than the initial corn itself. But we get our sugars from corn. In Brazil, they get their sugars from sugarcane, and that's just direct sugar. And in fact, sugarcane produces ethanol at a price about a third less than corn. And eventually, we'll be getting our sugars from cellulosic materials. So rather than the corn kernel, we'll get it from the corn stalk, or we'll get it from switchgrass, or we'll get it from fast-growing trees. And there, we have to break down the cellulose into the sugar. So I think that people, although I'm supportive of both biodiesel and ethanol, I think people should consider, in terms of a significant displacement of oil, even with plug-in hybrid electric flexible fueled cars, that sugars may be are much more abundant than vegetable oils.
David Morse, I'm always hearing, though, about the environmental consequences. That is, we hear, for example, that to produce a gallon of ethanol uses more energy than using pure gasoline because of the energy it takes to grow the corn, harvest it, bring it to market, and so on. Is that wrong? Is it more efficient than I just described?
Yes, that is wrong, and I know you'll have a guest, Tad, who will criticize what I'm saying, and I think that your guests, it's a somewhat complex subject, so I'll try to be brief, but anybody who's interested in looking at it in detail, newrules1word.org is our website, and everything that I know is up there, and so people could go and take a look at it and look at the numbers. But basically, let's remember that when we start with oil, we start at zero and we work our way down. That is, the net energy oil is below one because it's non-replaceable. When we start out with the plant matter, we start out with a surplus of energy because basically when you take corn and you, let's just take corn itself, you put a seed in the ground and it increases its weight by 5,000 times within 100 days. And most of that increased weight comes from sunlight that powers the process. It comes from water. It comes from carbon dioxide. It comes from some trace minerals in the ground. I mean, it's not free energy because we use fossil fuels in our tractors. We use fossil fuels in our fertilizers, but we start with a benefit, and then we work our way down. And virtually everybody agrees. I think everybody actually agrees with the following statement: that the farmers have become more efficient in their energy use over the last 30 years. That is, they're getting higher yields per unit of fossil fuel input, and that ethanol plants have become dramatically more energy efficient over the last 25 years. And so now, in fact, the new generation of ethanol plants is closer to 1.6 or 1.7 to 1 in terms of net energy benefit. And there are two energy ethanol plants in Minnesota right now that are taking the corn stalks and taking the wood, and they're actually displacing all of their natural gas that's required for the heating for the operation of the ethanol plant itself, which is about 80-85% of all the energy in the ethanol plant, and they're displacing it with biomass. And so there you're actually moving, you know, very much toward a complete carbohydrate economy.
You mentioned that we have a biomass skeptic waiting in the wings. I want to bring him in now. I'm happy to introduce Tadeusz Paczek. He's joining us from Berkeley, California. He's professor of geoengineering at the University of California at Berkeley. And Mr. Paczek, thanks for joining us.
Hello. Thank you.
Now, we've heard a great scenario laid out by our guest, and by David Morse. You're a skeptic. Tell us why. What's wrong with his case, with the idea of a carbohydrate economy?
Well, as Dave said, it's a long and convoluted subject, so I'll try to also keep it simple.
Yeah, and keep in mind we've got some callers who are dying to get in,
exactly.
but please go ahead.
Let's take Brazil as an example. if, and, you know, the popular story goes that Brazil is a self-sufficient energetically country. If we wanted to emulate Brazil in the United States, you and I could only use our cars once a month, in fact, once in 32 days. So for us to become a Brazil and to talk, about replacing fossil fuels with renewable fuels would mean that once in 32 days we're going to go to work and do our shopping. This is the scale at which we use fossil fuels. And in order for us to talk about hydrocarbon economy with all its other minuses, which I'll be glad to explain later on, we will have to dramatically redo and remake the way we live.
Very interesting. Tadeusz Paczek, let me just follow up on that. We would have to dramatically redesign, remake, redo the way we live in society, the way we design society. How would we have to do that? Suburbs, for example, would have to go.
Well, we would have to, in fact, this would be nothing short of a New Deal and a Manhattan Project and an Apollo Project brought together. And within this framework, we would have to redesign our cities, our suburbs, our highway system, our mass transportation systems, the way we obtain energy for light and for heat. And we would have to slow down and reassess how we use our time and perhaps take some quality time off instead of being on 24/7.
Well, that doesn't sound like such a bad idea. Do you disagree with that, David Morris?
Well, I disagree with pretty much all of it. Brazil does not pretend to energy self-sufficiency, so I'm not exactly clear what Tad was getting at. But 40% of Brazilian gasoline has been replaced by sugarcane, and I believe Tad thinks that sugarcane is not a net energy generator either. So in some ways, it's unclear about the one day a month. Secondly, is Tad is. Has a methodology which leads him to very pessimistic conclusions, and I appreciate his analysis, but I think that we shouldn't be stuck on ethanol, because in fact Tad's analysis leads him to believe that renewable energy of all kinds in fact can only provide a very, very tiny percentage of our energy needs, and that we really need to consider an aggressive increase in our use of nuclear power. And his colleague David Pimentel. And mentor, I believe, Tad would say, believes that basically the photosynthetic capacity of the world, that is the ability of the world to produce plants, is such that we can only survive just on feeding the world. We can only feed about 2 billion people a year, not the 6 billion people that we have. So it's a methodology that does lead to, you know, very, very pessimistic conclusions.
Mr. Paczek, he says maybe you're focusing too much only on ethanol, and that you're a bit of a your analysis is a little pessimistic, over pessimistic about the potential of biofuels.
Yes. Well, I am in fact not focusing on ethanol. Ethanol is just a current vehicle of delivering biomass to the market. What I'm focusing on is sort of the fundamental principles of nature and of science that describes that nature, which tell us that biomass can be only produced at a very limited rate. And in order to speed up its production, it has to be subsidized massively with fossil fuels. And that's a fact. It's very difficult to dispute that. Biomass grows not in vacuum, but it grows on good soil. If it were only solar energy that drove biomass, you know, a corn seed to grow 5,000 times in 100 days, then we should be growing corn on the Sahara Desert. There's much more sun over there. So obviously corn is not growing on the Sahara Desert. It is growing in the Midwest because of its plentiful rain, and because of what remains of the wonderful rich prairie system, which we have been gradually damaging and destroying for the last 120 years. Mm. That prairie system, which is now cornfields and wheat fields and soybean fields, is deteriorating. And in fact, it's deteriorating very fast. Half of the topsoil is gone, and the rest of it may be going rather quickly. Despite heroic measures undertaken by many farmers.
So are you saying we just don't have the land and the irrigable soil to make this dream come true?
Well, we do not have the land, we do not have excess water, and we do not have excess fertilizers, which are all derived from fossil fuels. There are these three things. And then when Mr. Morris is talking about taking corn stalks and wood chips and everything else, these things happen to have nutrients which need to be returned to the soil, because otherwise that soil will die. And so when we start taking all plants, not just grain, from the cornfields, the first thing that's going to happen is that the first rain is going to get rid of much of the topsoil, which is exposed and not covered with the corn stalk. And so if you talk to a farmer and you tell the farmer that you want to remove the whole plant, the farmer will say you must be crazy. Literally, I was told that at one of the meetings in which Mr. Morris was also present. So all I'm trying just to say, because, you know, is that fundamental science can be summarized by this very short poem by Longfellow, which basically says this: nothing useless is or low. Each thing in its place is best. And what seems but idle show strengthens and supports the rest. So what we do, we basically yank one element of a very complicated picture, we focus on that one element, we draw our optimistic conclusions, and we forget about the big picture.
Okay. David Morris, I know you're dying to respond to that, but I do want to get one or two callers in, so just hold off, if you will. Let's go to Mel, who's calling from Fitchburg, Massachusetts. Hi, Mel.
Hi.
What's on your mind? Thanks for the call.
Thank you for the call. The time that we've been looking at this problem has been over 40 years. And there have been people who were concerned with these problems 30, 40 years ago. There's been lots of publications, and we weren't paying attention to it. And we put a lot of effort in keeping some things from happening. Solar energy, the politics, I'm afraid that the politics and the economics of it have really gone out of proportion.
So Mel, your point is that after waiting 30 or 40 years to get serious about this, the cost of implementing this is going to cost much more than it would have. Is that the idea?
Yes. There have been organizations like New Alchemy Institute that uses biomass. They've set in various things around the country, Burlington, Vermont being one of them. And the cost to do that today is twice the amount that it was done at the time that they put those things in.
Okay, Mel, let me throw that idea over to David Morris. David, respond to Mel. I mean, is he right about that? And how does that affect your optimism about what's possible?
Well, he's right about that. But, you know, let's understand that if we were having this conversation in 1975, and I was around working with the Ford Energy Office in 1975 and in 1978 with the Carter administration, if we were around then, I would probably lay out the same strategy, if I could think of it, but then you'd say, but there's no businesses out there that are producing this. There's no technologies that are available. I mean, we were very much at the beginning. And now, yes, we should have done things faster, but in 2006, we're talking about all of the technologies being available. I mean, an ethanol plant in 1978 used just the ethanol plant, forget about growing the corn, used twice as much energy to make the ethanol as was contained in a gallon of ethanol in 1978. We went through a learning curve around that. And now that ethanol plant is about 75% more efficient than it was. So we've learned about that. We've got a wind electricity that's substantial. It's an industry. We've got hybrid cars. Plug-in hybrid cars are on the road, although they're on the road as prototypes. So I'm very optimistic that in 2006 we can literally be talking about, let's go from 1% of the energy picture to 50% or 75%, whereas in 1975 and 1980, we were talking about, let's invent the technologies and see if they're reliable.
Hmm. Tadeusz Paczek, you know, there are skeptics, other skeptics like you. I was reading recently Jim Kunstler, who's author of the book The Long Emergency, and he rails against the kind of ideas that David Morris is putting forward. He says, you know, the post-oil world is almost upon us. We're not prepared. No combination of wind, solar, ethanol, biomass can ever make up for the loss of cheap oil. And his vision is a bleak one. American society as we know it will be forced out of existence. Suburbs will collapse. Long commutes will not be possible. Cities will be unsustainable. Is your vision that dark? Or is there, do you have a happy idea about how we're going to live in this post-cheap oil world?
Okay. Well, my vision is not that dark. However, I have to tell you, and I have to stress it to your listeners, that we are not prepared. The sort of Pollyanna-type stories propagated by David Morris and many others have the soothing effect on people who think that if they fill up their Chevy Tahoe or whatever SUV with E85, they can go on driving like they did and feel happy about it and positive. That is patently untrue. There is no scheme in existence that will replace the rate at which we are using fossil fuels. We can draw them through some very big pipes at a very high rate and support a lifestyle which is absolutely unsupportable, unsustainable with anything else. And so if we want to switch to something else, we would have to decrease the use of energy in our society by, now listen carefully, by a factor of 20, not 2, but 20, okay? Now, how are we going to do that? This is not going to happen by trying to use up grease from a local restaurant. This is going to happen by redesigning all our cities, all our suburbs, as I said, and I agree with Mr. Kunst, although I read his paper for the first time today. He, in principle, based on science, he is absolutely right. He's also right in telling us that we have this optimism, which is good. We need a lot of optimism to get through some very tough times, that somehow technology will save us and somehow will go around the laws of nature. Unfortunately, it shall not.
David Morris, I want to give you a chance to respond to that. It sounds like Dr. Pacek sees your vision as a little too Pollyannish. Don't we need to include your vision with some very tough talk about how society has to be reorganized?
Well, of course. In fact, my vision requires, reorganizing society. See, that's an interesting thing. Someone once said to me, optimism is the best working hypothesis. It's what gets you up in the morning and gets you going. And Tad's hypothesis, and I've said this before, he and David Pimentel, based on his fundamental principles of nature, say that the United States can only support, at a modest standard of living, 80 million people. 80 million people, and the world only 2 billion people. Well, that may be right. I mean, let's have a discussion about that. But when he says we need a 20-fold decrease in the amount of energy, by all means, come up with a strategy that's commensurate with that proposition. I've come up with a strategy that I think is commensurate with the scale of the problem, and it's a strategy which is based on current technology, and it's a strategy that I think could be, it is in place in little bits and pieces, and can in fact be brought together. I think that talking about an E85, suburban, Yukon, SUV or something like that, I think it really kind of belittles what I'm saying here. I'm saying that we would have plug-in hybrid electric vehicles. 75% of the energy that you use would be electricity for the vehicles. We do not use oil in the generation of electricities, although we do use coal and we do use natural gas and we do use nuclear power. We would need very few, if any, increased power plants, because we would use the electricity during the night, off-peak times, although we would burn more fuel by doing it, that the electric vehicle itself is 2 to 3 times more efficient than the internal combustion engine, and therefore you get to reduce your energy consumption overall, and that your backup engine, which you would use maybe 25% of the time, mostly on longer trips, would come from biomass, and we do have a sufficient amount of biomass to provide 100% displacement of oil to that backup engine. That's my strategy, and we can start doing it today.
Gentlemen, we're going to have to leave it there because our precious time is another precious resource that we just ran out of. David Morris, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having
me. Appreciate it. David Morris is Vice President, the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. He joined us from St. Paul, Minnesota. And Tadeusz Pacek, thank you for joining us very much.
Thank you.
This is On Point.
Thank you.